So this is chapter 4, rules for Snataka, means for that brahmachari who is graduated from the Gurukul and now is, living the life of, you know, he's practicing the brahminical occupational duties. And living in the home. 146. No calamity happens to those who eagerly follow auspicious customs and the rule of good conduct, to those who are always careful of purity, and to those who mutter sacred texts and offer burnt oblations. So we mentioned before is we see it's always mentioning these aspects. Also was doing that in the second chapter. Auspicious customs, rule of good conduct. So that's the Vedic aspects there, the purity. Those who mutter the sacred texts, you know, which is the act of study and the pancharatrik side in that. And those who offer burnt oblations, who perform, also do this worship. Or mutter the sacred text would be also the chanting of the mantras, chanting of the Lord's name. So these aspects, the Bhagavat, meaning the worship of the Lord, the pancharatrik, which is all the rituals and the process of, you know, the ritualistic process of the worship. And then the customs and rules of good conduct there. And then purity. Because purity, you're trying to raise yourself from the platform of ignorance to the platform of goodness to pure goodness. So unless there's cleanliness outside and inside, then it's very hard to elevate oneself. If everything is dirty, then it's very difficult to elevate oneself. That's why always so much external purity is there, the trying for the internal purity, the surroundings are pure, everything is pure like that. That is what we are trying to establish. So no calamity happens to anyone who does these things. Now it's very important to understand what is the meaning also here of the calamity. Basically is generally if one always performs good activities, calamities come for those who perform bad activities. Because you perform a bad activity, you get a bad reaction. You perform a good activity, you have a good reaction. But other than that, then there's the point of no calamity means that one does not give up one's proper consciousness, Krishna consciousness, these kind of aspects. That's also very important. That's the real calamity. Because the real good is what is coming from being Krishna conscious. And real bad is forgetting Krishna. So that's also a very important aspect. So we see Haridas Thakur, even though he's you know, the dealings aren't so overly pleasant. You know, they're not the kind of activities you expect on the heavenly planet, with two constables beating you in 22 Malechya markets. But to him there's no calamity, because he's in Krishna consciousness. He's remembering Krishna, he's not forgetting. So it doesn't bother him. You know, of course, this is an extreme case, giving the example, you know, by an acharya. But the principle is there that this is the real understanding of no calamity. Then from the aspect, if you just follow Krishna's rules nicely, then generally you'll always see that the atmosphere will be very good. But it must always be remembered the mode of goodness is still material. It may be the best situation in the material world to establish oneself on to perform service, but still, it's still weak. Because unless you're using that for the chanting of the holy name and for doing all these things, then it's a weak situation, right? Just like Prabhupada when he went to Hawaii, he said this is for the sages and munis, saintly people. You know, it's meant for yogis to sit and do their meditation. It's peaceful, all fruits and flowers. Everything's there, just abundant. You don't have to work, you know. Everything's just very, very nice. There's caves there, so many coconuts and other fruit trees. You just, you know, just take what you need, sit down, perform your sadhana, your worship of the Lord with what's available, and that's all. But we see that people have taken this and made it into a gross place of sense gratification, you know, tourism and, you know, just like this. So the situation, the mode of goodness can be used to advantage for someone who wants to, or it can be used for sense gratification also. So if the tendency is towards using it nicely in Krishna's service, then Krishna will give that. You know, it'll remain like that. And even if one is using Krishna's service, even if it doesn't remain like that, one will not be disturbed. But for someone who will use the peaceful mode of goodness atmosphere for sense gratification, then generally you find calamity is given to wake one up to the realities of life. Because for them, material calamity is a disaster. Right? But for the devotee, then whether it's materially nice or not, doesn't really matter to him like that. But for one who uses Krishna's energy for oneself, then it is a big problem. So here you can read it on both these levels. Is that if one is more interested in sakam karma, then if you follow the rules, there'll be no material calamity. And if one's on the nishkam, there's no calamity, means one's to Krishna consciousness will always be steady. 147. Let him without tiring daily mutter the Veda at the proper time, for they declare that to be one's highest duty. All other observances are called secondary duties. So it says without tiring means one should always be able to do day in, day out. This idea of a holiday is kind of a more modern thing. I remember when Prabhupada was here, nobody talked about holidays like that. The idea is that I work hard and then you need a break from that. Like that, and just, that's another thing. The idea is that then it goes, Prabhupada talks about bhog tyag, bhog tyag. It was naturally there that the saintly persons would preach very, very, how you say, dynamically for 8 months, and then for 4 months they would sit down and just study, do sadhana, study, discuss with other like-minded persons, like those six Mahabhagavats at Narad Muni's, you know, place. That house where his mother was working as a maid servant, is they would come and they just sat there, and then they studied, and then they talk amongst themselves about what they've studied and their understandings, realizations, and like that. And so So that's not a holiday, right? Because the preaching is ecstatic, the sitting down is ecstatic. One's always happy. But it's just that there must be study, the renewal of you gain more information, and then by more understanding, deeper understanding, realization by that service, and then when one goes out and dynamically preaches, and one gets great realization and understanding from that. So they complement each other. But the idea that I work very nice and then just something off, and you know, don't bother with the sadhana, and just, you know, do this and do that, and you know, it's just have a good time, then that one has to be very, very careful about that concept. So without tiring, it's just his sadhana always goes on. His chanting and that. And here it's mentioning mutter the Veda at the proper time. So his recitation of the Vedic mantras, which basically contain the names of the Lord and all that. So the chanting, that is mentioned here, that daily must go on. That's declared. It says, for they declare, means all the great sages and everybody declares that that's the highest duty. You know? So chanting the Lord's names, hearing the scriptures like that, and, you know, in the association of devotees, this is the most important. Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam. These are the most important. If one is doing that, then that is very good. And if one is not, then there's a problem. So everything else is secondary to that. Right? So at the Vedic time, these would be the aspects of the Bhagavat. You know? Because it's worked in. The Vedic has the Bhagavat in it. Right? But it may be more hidden. Because in the Vedic thing, someone who's more materialistic can relate to the external. My body goes through a particular ritual. It's at a particular standard of purity, someone else is at a less standard of purity, all these different things you can see very nicely from the external. But but within that, then there's the aspect of hearing and chanting, remembering the Lord, which is basically the essential point, and hearing from others, like transcendental subject matter. So this is the essential Bhagavat principles. you know, then the ritual aspect of it that is being done to worship the Lord, that is there, though it's also maybe used for demigods, other things like that, but the actual Vedic culture is for worshiping the Lord. So those things, the ritual side of it, the cultural side of it, those are secondary to the chanting. So the holy name always must be the central feature of it. 148. By daily reciting the Veda, by the observance of the rules of purification, by practicing austerities, by doing no injury to created beings, one obtains the faculty of remembering former births. So here you're daily reciting the scriptures, the Lord's holy name, by performing the observance of purity, the standards of purity, how to clean oneself internally, externally. Then by practicing austerities, that means the body, the mind, and words, cleanliness, simplicity, proper speaking, according to Shastra, being straightforward in dealings, respecting others, you know, these things are austerities. By doing no injury to created beings, so that compassion, that niceness that is there. So it begins, if you can get yourself to not hurt others, then that means you become conscious of others. One may just say, well, if I don't do that, that doesn't mean anything, but it's a lot. You have to be conscious. I don't kill the ants, I don't bother the other birds, this, that, like I was just here the other day. And one of the two boys were walking by one of the trees, and there was a coquille in the tree. And, you know, it's springtime now, and, you know, the coquilles get very excited in the spring and that, and Krishna, that's why Krishna keeps them in the dham, because they make nice sounds, they sing in five different notes, like that. So he likes them. So this one started singing very loudly, and one of the boys, you know, thought it was too loud, told him to be quiet, you know, like this. So I asked the boy why. He says, oh, he's so loud. You know, but the point is the coquille is making these sounds for Krishna's pleasure, for Chaitanya's pleasure, like that. So we should be happy knowing these are auspicious birds Krishna likes. It's that, you know, so this is Lord Chaitanya's place. We're a servant here, you know. Lord Chaitanya will worry about if they're too loud or too soft, you know, like that. We don't have, it's not like they're sitting in our class and making a whole bunch of noise, you know. They're in the tree doing their thing, and we're walking by doing nothing specific. So these things where it becomes gentle. Just like you'll many times see is a bird, if it comes and lands, or a squirrel comes and lands close. Many times I've seen is someone who's untrained, the first thing they'll do when they see it is move their hand really quick to try to scare them. It's very common. You come around a corner and there's a bird standing there on the path where you want to go, immediately just move your hand, flip your hand to scare them off. You know, rather than, okay, they're on the path, you move to one side, they'll move to the other side. You know, path big enough for, you know, definitely one human and one bird. You know, it's not like they take up a lot of space. And if you come around the corner, there's an elephant in the middle of the path, that's another thing. But then flipping your hand's not going to get rid of them. So. But the idea is that one is, takes on that gentleness. So that, and that means then you become sensitive to others. And you become aware of others and what they're thinking, what they're doing. So it develops this ability to then properly reciprocate with others. This gives rise to the whole culture and the application of everything. You know, what we get in the philosophy, etiquette, culture. Without that, you can't. And that then, naturally, the next step is the compassion, the preaching. Is that when you're sensitive to others, then you understand that they're suffering. They're absorbed in birth, death, old age, and disease. So that compassion is there, right? You don't disturb the animal because he's doing just what he feels the need to do. He has the desire to do that. The animal needs to do that. That's his mood, his attachment. So then also for the conditioned living entities, they have a need to do those things. It means they feel the need. They don't actually need, but they feel the need. So then because of that, then we see the sages and all that give them that space. But at the same time, is they know that the ultimate need, the ultimate anxiety, is lack of Krishna consciousness. So then they're trying to always correct that. Find some way that this person in his conditioned state can be elevated. How to elevate that person? He's having problem, how to elevate? how to bring about a, you know, benefit for this person, like that. Then, yeah, one obtains the faculty of remembering former births, that we remember that, because that we are conditioned, we've been in the material world since time immemorial. You know, many will be into this, oh, I can remember, you know, mystically, you know, like people are into regression and all that. It's attractive to know what you were in your last birth. But Krishna lets us forget, because otherwise, you know, sometimes it may be very annoying. In this birth, then there's so much problem. In last birth, this birth we were very poor, and then we remember last birth, find out we were very, very rich, but because we didn't take care of the money, therefore we're poor this life. That would be very painful. No one likes to find out what their wrongs, you know, their bad qualities. But the idea of this mystic finding other births is attractive. We see it's a very, you know, before it was, in modern thing it was. That's why people look at the astrology. What's the future? What was the past? Right? The astrologer always starts talking about known past. And then when he tells, oh, you did this at this time, did that at that time, your mother's like this, father's like this, you have this many brothers, sisters, so many different things, then you go, oh, this person knows something. Then when he tells you about the future, you'll believe it. You know? So that's the thing. So going into past lives is an attractive thing. That's the materialistic side of it, you know, because the Vedic thing gives something for those who are interested in pure devotional service, those who are interested in devotional service but still keeping their own desires, and then those who are not interested in devotional service. It'll be geared at all these levels. So then for those who are interested in devotional service seriously, then you have the aspect of remembering means we remember we've been in the material world since time immemorial because of the material desires. That's how we ended up in this life. So you don't necessarily need to know the particulars of a specific lifetime, that you were born in this place and you lived in this street, on this house, in this room, you know, like that. Not that. It means you understand material existence. You understand. It means the one is you may remember a few births in the, you know, here. But what we're talking about here is remembering the whole existence, back to where it is that you came through. You know, what are the desires that brought you through? You know, like this. So this is more important, because this gets you out. The other one doesn't. You know, knowing that one was, you know, Queen Victoria in one's last life doesn't necessarily free one from material existence. You know, knowing you were Mozart or, you know, something, what frees you is knowing that desires in this way have created this body. Right? So it sounds, well, that's very simple. But if it's realized, one gives up material life. So if one hasn't given up, one hasn't realized that. That's why he's saying you do all this, then you gives the faculty of remembering former births. Right? You understand how we get into the material world, you know, not the point where does the jiva fall from. The point of understanding is by our material desire, then those roots, and like we were discussing in the morning, that all my problems with all the cooking and the serving and the utensils and the pots and the restaurants and all the different things and the indigestion, all that comes because I have the desire to eat. Right? So when I realize that all my anxiety is coming because I desire to eat, right? Then that you can clear away all the other aspects on what things I eat, where I eat it, how I eat it, with who I eat it, in what situation I eat it, you know, like that. All those are cleared away. Those are side. Those are like you have the main desire, and then these are all like the maidservants of that desire. So then you're able to get back to the original desires, you know, the six pushings, you know. These things, these are the roots, you know, the desire to control, the desire to enjoy. That control comes from envy, right? From envy of our relationship with Krishna, envy of Krishna's position as the enjoyer. We think, I should be the enjoyer, I'm not the servant. That creates fear. And that is the desire to control. It's all connected. So whenever it says become fearless, you know, like that, that means to accept that we're Krishna's servant, become his, and take up that mood. Then that gets rid of envy. To become non-envious means to accept our relationship with Krishna and others' relationship with Krishna. It's the same aspect of the tattva. Right? Become peaceful means to become free from material desire, the desire to enjoy. Right? So one becomes free from envy and attachment. Right? What is that? Vitaraga bhaya krodha. Right? So because the next thing after these two, so the one is the karma, right? The attachment, the raga. And the bhaya, that's the gyan, the impersonal. We're afraid of our relationship with the Lord. You know? Like that. So these two are there. Okay. 149. He who recollects his former existences again recites the Veda, gains endless bliss by the continual study of the Veda. Who, recollecting his former existences again recites the Veda, gains endless bliss by the continual study of the Veda. Because then you understand the Veda, what it said, it's going on. It's chewing the chew. Shastra is saying this, and then you see all that, and then you understand the material world, there isn't a whole lot here. It looks like there's a lot, but there's not a whole lot happening. It's not. You know, it's just like you go into a big theater, big pandal, and there's so many lights going and this and colors and things happening and sounds. And then you follow it back and you find, you know, there's one guy at a little board there, and he's pushing a few little buttons and making a few lights, you know, 10, 15 lights move. And, you know, two speakers or a few speakers are moving. So that's it. But it looks like so much is happening. You know, and it comes down to that. Well, there's all these lights. Yeah, but the lights all go back to the, you know, and back to these little switchboards and back to, and it's just, you know, it's just the whole thing just kind of like dissolves.
Wizard of Oz.
Huh?
Like the Wizard of Oz.
Yeah. You know, the mystique, you know, it's like they, you have that, is that the, something looks far out, but when you know what it is, the mystique is gone. And then the interest is lost. So the material world, they don't understand the principle of this, so then newer and newer, the mystique is lost in one thing, so you look for it in something else. But the Vedic thing is understand you lose the mystique of the whole process, and then it's just dropped. Okay. Gains endless bliss by continual study of the Veda. Endless bliss. So that's one, is that he's very happy now, but endless bliss means you can attain the spiritual world. In other words, you've given up your attachment to the material nature and become attached to the spiritual nature. Right? Yeah. What's this? Okay. 150. Let him always offer on the Parva days oblations to Savitri and such as avert evil omens, and on the Astakas and Anvastakas, let him constantly worship the manes. So these are aspects for those who are interested in the Karmakanda aspect, our devotees. These details aren't so important. Is that the Parvas are the what? The first, what is it? The first, the eighth? 14th, what are the Parvas? I don't know. 50, 70, okay. Oblations to Savitri means there's, you know, there's, whatever. 151, far from his dwelling, let him, let him remove urine and ordure. It's a pretty fancy name. The water used for washing his feet, and the remnants of food and the water from his bath. In other words, all the things that are dirty, they should be far from the place where one lives. Right? In other words, the Vedic culture wasn't too hot on attached baths. Like that. You know, there would always be a distance between the house and where these things were. So some distance is good, because then the house is more clean. The air is always clean, the atmosphere is clean. You know, diseases are less, you know, everything is just more pure like that. Well, if everything's very, very close, then it becomes more difficult. You see in all in India, in all the old, the dharmshalas and old houses, even in very big aristocratic houses like that, I've seen in some big, one in Calcutta, one big, huge, what do you call it? Mansion, like a three-story mansion. The house was monstrous, but it's an old one, you know, like made in the 60s or 50s, like that, or maybe even before 40s or something. And the toilet, shower, all that, is in a different building. It's right next to it, but it's distance, and you have to cross a little bridge from each floor. It means the house is three floors. The toilet and bath block is also three floors, one for each floor. But it's in a separate building with all the pipes and all those, you know, all that in that building. They don't go near the other building. And there's a little walkway, little small walkway that goes across to that level like that. And you have this big, you know, so this is big, you know, this huge, huge joint family living in this house, you know, 50, 60 people, very wealthy. You know, the whole place is really decked out in gutties and nice wood, everything like that. But in their mind, it's not clean to properly have this. You see all the old dharmshalas, everything. It's a separate building. Though it may be, you know, there's some connection, but it's a separate building. The toilet pipes don't run through the building. Like nowadays, you see many times how they build the houses, so each one is a little different. You have the guys above you, toilet pipes running through your kitchen. You know, it's not uncommon, or through your living room, and they kind of like close it up a little bit, and then your wall's always a little wet because the guys upstairs shower or something leaks a little bit, and this and that, and you know, that's a, you seem to be laughing. You know this well, huh? Yeah. You know, it's like that, but it's not uncommon. So those things create disease and all that kind of stuff. Create disease. You know, so it's just, and the atmosphere becomes polluted and all this. So one always tries to arrange. Of course, one has to be practical. But the point is that one should see that this is very clean. You know, if he is living in a more modern environment where he gets stuck with these kind of things, then he should see that they're very clean, or try to choose his dwelling so that, you know, you don't have the toilet, you know, the entrance, you know, through the kitchen, or, you know, stuff like that. You know, you find things where you can keep it more pure, like that. Huh? What are you laughing about?
I have this house, you know, in Austria. If you go to the bathroom, you have to go to the kitchen to go into the bathroom to wash up.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very common in my parents.
Yes. So it's just they pick whatever's the worst and do that through the kitchen. Because the idea is it's all water, so put it all together. Like that. It's all water. You know, you put that all in one place rather than there's clean water and dirty water. Like that. Where's he going? Why, we were speaking of water so much. You got thirsty. You got thirsty, we're talking about water and all that. Okay. 52. Early in the morning only, let him void stool and urine, decorate his body, bathe, clean his teeth, apply cudgel to the eyes, and worship the gods. So it means that very early these activities should be done. It means first thing, getting up. One, that means you have to get up early. And then two, all these things are done. These are the normal things. Pancharatra follows the same thing. You get up in the morning, you go to the toilet, you know, you bathe, you decorate you clean yourself, clean the teeth, take your bath, you know, decorate the body. Decoration means tilak, neck beads, Brahmin thread, sika, you know, dhoti, chadar, saris. This is decorating the body. You know, putting the Lord's names like this. And then worship the Lord. So it's a standard thing. It means the pancharatrik. It means the Vedic has come out from out of the pancharatrik. Because the pancharatrik is the essence of the Veda. So naturally, what's in the Pancharatrik is already there in the Veda. Then, okay.
How does one regulate the body?
regulates so that one is going to the toilet in the morning. See, one uses the toilet in the morning generally when the stomach has means when the stomach has digested whatever is there or can't digest it and decides to get rid of it. That's when one uses the toilet. So one should, you know, adjust the diet and everything so that it's digested by that time, then it's much more natural. Also, if you drink plenty of liquids, then one doesn't generally end up with constipation. And, you know, like that. One knows these things and one starts to adjust. If one knows it's bad to go to the toilet after eating, then one finds that happens, then one has to see, well, am I eating too much or the wrong things or this or that, and slowly, slowly start to adjust so that these things are... Who's that crew in there? Oh, it's in the mind of the other devotee. Well, they came in that way. Maybe Gauri can explain to him they should come in through the front and not through the back. And not to wander around the house. They can just see here and go out. We should just start training them. House train them. House training the tour guides. Okay. But on the Parva days, let him go to visit the deities and the virtuous brahmanas and the ruler of the country, for the sake of protection, as well as his gurus. Okay. So it means on, in other words, there's these, I can't remember what the Parva days are. But on, I think the Parva days are days when they don't study. No, Hare Krishna. Parva days are days when they don't study. So when they don't study, so those days, then he's mentioned here, then they should do extra worship of the Lord, you know, studying, visiting, you know, going to the temple, and going to the temple, meeting, you know, how do you say, associating with advanced devotees. These are the days to visit and keep contact with one's authorities, like that. And as well as one's teachers. In other words, the days that are off for the study and these things, for the in other words, the days that you have off from performing your occupational duties, right? Because the brahmanas, they study and they teach. So if teaching is stopped, then those days are used for increasing one's sadhana, or increasing one's association, increasing one's worship. These are the aspects that are being done. In other words, one shouldn't waste the time. It's not that is the holiday. We're looking for holiday. That's what we do. We increase the sadhana, associate with those who are more advanced. Huh?
A holy.
Yes, holy day. Yeah, it's probably how it started off, right? A holy day was, you know, I guess in the Western thing was originally Saturday, and then somehow or another by the Roman savages, then it changed to Sunday. Like that, and then, you know, there's more who are more enthusiastic, so they get Saturday and Sunday. Have they started anyway 4-day weeks? I know that was in the pipeline.
Many years in school was Friday was half day, and Saturday, Sunday free.
Yeah. I know they were discussing that. I forget if it was Australia or America or someplace, some years back, but I don't know if it happened. Probably figure out the economic loss would be too great. You know, sort of like that. But the point is those days are used for benefiting oneself by increased hearing and chanting and association. That's what it's for.
Are those days, like, they have results like Chaturdasi and Purnima, destruction of teacher, destruction of student? How serious we take these, like, teaching someone, and Chaturdasi will bring all the destruction of the student?
That's generally if you're those are specifically for fruitive activities. For, you know, the study is for the purpose of fruitive benefit. So those aren't. But if it's being done for Krishna conscious, so that means the apara vidya being used for sakam. You know? Like that. It means material knowledge. The dovetail material knowledge is being used for one's own desires, own purposes. That then one is more careful about those days. But since we're chanting Hare Krishna and these kind of things, and our activities are supposed to be, and what we're learning is supposed to be for pleasing Krishna, then those aren't so important. You know, because glorification of Krishna, associating with devotees, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, that goes on, that's nitya, nitya seva. Right? The nitya kriyas, we do that every day. And in the Pancharatra, you have two divisions. There's the nitya kriyas and naimittik kriyas. So chanting, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, associating with devotees, worshipping the deity, living in the dham, worshipping Tulsi, taking care of guests, taking prasad, like that, chant, all these things are all nitya, daily activities. So those aren't obstructed. The Pancharatra and the Bhagavat aren't obstructed. The Vedic are if it's for karmakanda purposes. But the Vedic, if it's being, it uses the support for Pancharatra and Bhagavat, then doesn't have these difficulties. Does that make some sense? Yeah. Fifty-four. Let him reverentially salute venerable men who visit him, give them his own seat, let him sit near them with joined hands, and when they leave, accompany them, walking behind them. Yeah, so it's here he's going out and visiting all these virtuous Brahmins and the teachers, gurus, and all this, but it mentions if they come to visit him, then he should give his own seat, you know, like that, and sit and hear from them nicely, respect them. And then when they go, he should follow, right? It's not that just, you're leaving, yeah, see you later, and that's it. You get up and follow them for some distance, you know, at least out of the house or up to the, you know, edge of the property, or, you know, minimum, you know, out of the house, 7 steps, or off the property, 7 steps, like that. It's always the kind of the general. They should go with them some ways, because that's shown a sign of respect and sign of affection that's there. Otherwise, if one just as soon as they're finished and then you leave, then, you know, you just, they're going and then you, yeah. Then it's just, one's too attached to one's comfortable arrangement, and it's not so much you're seeing them off. So that's always, that respect must be there. Okay. Let him untired follow the conduct of virtuous men connected with his occupations, which has been fully declared in the revealed texts and in the sacred tradition, Smriti, and is the root of the sacred law. So here again, let him untired follow the conduct of virtuous men, means following the example of the great personalities, how they followed the direction of the scriptures. Right? Like that. This is the aspect. Is that one must always be willing to follow. You know, it's just like, what is it? Someone's saying I can't remember what's this phrase, but it basically means that what you value is what you do when no one's looking. Basically, you know, everyone's looking and you're very clean and you do this and that, but when no one's looking, you don't bother. Then cleanliness isn't your value. If no one's around, no one will see, and you're still worried about your cleanliness and this and that, then that means that is your value. Then, you know, feel free if anyone has anything to say or ask, and just as we go, bring it up. 156. Through virtuous conduct, he obtains long life. Through virtuous conduct, desirable offspring. Through virtuous conduct, imperishable wealth. Virtuous conduct destroys the effect of inauspicious marks. So inauspicious marks, one is on the, you have the subtle ones that are the desires on the soul, I mean not on the soul, on the subtle body, is that the material desires that they mark, and they you know, what we would call bad qualities in one's personality and all that. So by proper conduct, it destroys that. Personality is not going to change, it will be purified. Right? Conditioned nature is a conditioned nature that will remain. Just like, so you purify the body, it's still going to look the same, though it'll look pure. You know, you can see, you have somebody, and they look very pure, and if they get bad association, when you see them next time, they look very dark and not very pure. Or if they were like that before, and they come into good association, then they start to look very pure. But the personality is there. It's just now it's in its pure state or its dark state. So that aspect, you're removing those inauspicious marks, and then on the just how it manifests in the body. What inauspicious marks are there, they slowly may adjust themselves. I've seen that. Someone who lives in the Dham long time, their body changes. When they come, many times they have their very squarish, kind of rough Western kind of look, that harsh. And when they're here a long time, then they start to become much more smooth and gentle and refined looking. I've seen, after someone's many, many years, I've seen that happen like that. So that aspect, in other words, just that when it's there in the gross body means it's very prominent in the subtle body, and that then affects one's behavior and other things like that. So someone has, just like someone's, many times you see hunchbacks, they're super observant, right? Kautilya then recommends that they're used as spies, hunchbacks. Because hunchback is someone no one regards. No one takes seriously. They're always, slinking around here and there, and no one notices them. But hunchbacks are super observant. Why? Because they want to walk around straight, and they notice everybody else, and they're jealous of that or envious of that. So just by nature, they're looking at everybody and what they got, and because they can work, then they're so wealthy, and because they can't, then they're very poor, and everything like that. And so they're very, very observant of everyone else.
Montara.
Huh?
Montara.
Oh, she was hunchback?
Wasn't she?
Was she? Was she a hunchback?
Her
she was. Yeah, see, so she's just looking, and they overworked their brain. But the thing is, you're supposed to know how much you take them seriously and how much not.
So, know that
yeah, that's just their nature. So it's the kings will engage them, and they'll say so many things, yeah, this, that, and speculate on this and that, and then the king gets out of it what he wants, and then rewards him. Oh, very nice, gives him a pearl necklace and sends them on their way. And he takes about half of what they said. Because he knows that they because you're using the advantage that they see everything, but not how they interpret all that. So the point is what is there in the physical form then is there because of what's in the subtle. So what you see in the external, then that may have some rough aspects to it. Some roughness to it. So by always following virtuous conduct, that will remove that. Doesn't mean that the hunchback won't be a hunchback, but he'll start to lose those kind of hunchback qualities. that nastiness and all those. Ability to observe is not the inauspicious mark. It's the jealousy, the enviousness, the speculativeness. That's the aspect that's inauspicious. Huh? Oh, yeah, but just bring the small ones. Bring the small table then.
How far should the body has to be dealt with as well? There's a hunchback to the body. And then you have to also see them as a devotee.
Yeah, no, they're devotee. It just means that this will be their strength and weakness. Like, if you want to know what's going on in the ashram, ask the hunchback. They see everything. Like that. But at the same time, is unless they're, as they advance in their devotional life, then you can also accept their interpretation of what they see. But they're devotees. These things aren't, that just means there's been some severe, impropriety in the past in some way. And therefore they ended up in that situation. But otherwise it's not to be. These things aren't, Because the subtle body is more important. Because it may be one thing was done wrong and one ended up in that situation. But everything else is very nice, so they may be a very nice person and very, very intelligent and very... Well, someone else may have a very beautiful body because they've done the pious activity to get that. But everything else about them may be very bad. Very, very bad. Like... many times it's like actors and, you know, people, you know, cinema stars and all these, is that they're very beautiful and attractive, but their lifestyle and their moods are very bad, very many times. I mean, especially now, modern days, very bad. You know, like that, but they're physically very beautiful.
Sometimes the body is dead. They say, oh, it's better to marry somebody who's ugly.
Better to marry someone who's ugly. It's better to marry someone who has character. That's what you should look for, is the character. One shouldn't be looking so much for the physical beauty. Now, the physical beauty generally is a sign of piety that is there, but you also have to see that the character is there along with it. Because if the character is not there, a little closer, if the character is not there, then they only have enough piety to create a good-looking body. And marriage is not for marrying the body. You see the body, and then that gives some indication of what the personality is like that. You know, so if they're... the point is it's not you're looking to marry someone ugly. The point is you may marry someone who is not overly physically attractive. Like that. And that is different for different people, you know. Like that, you know, to a bull, a cow is very attractive, you know. Now, we may not be overly inclined to marry a cow, you know. So the point is if one is too overly attracted by the body, then that's going to distract one from the actual relationship of marriage. Like that. The marriage shouldn't be based on the attraction to the body. The marriage should be based on the relationship in service. Two like-minded persons have the same need of marriage to overcome their material conditioning. So therefore you find that like-mindedness, you know? Like that. So generally, someone who's very physically attractive themselves, there may not be a problem marrying someone else who's physically attractive. Someone who's not physically attractive generally won't marry someone else who's physically attractive. Because then they'll be overly attracted by that. You know? And that's to be avoided. But you also have to just see that the character is there. You know? That's the main thing. Because you can have somebody who's very pious and very nice and religious and devotional and not necessarily physically very attractive. And someone who's physically very attractive, but they're very proud of that. And they think that, well, if this man doesn't do what I want, then plenty of other men will be attracted to them. So then then this is very bad. Like that. One has to marry someone who has the proper attitude, you know, like that. Then marriage is there because someone identifies as a conditioned man and someone identifies as a conditioned woman, you know. And so woman means mother and the father, and the man means he should be guru, protector, you know, can give shelter, can give direction, you know. That aspect, like that. So that's a nice match. If the woman has more of a tigress mood, then she's not fitting the part. You know, there's no need. Tigers live alone. They don't live together. Tigers don't move in a group. They may come together for, you know, some conjugal dealings, but as soon as that's over, then they're gone. They live alone. They're loners. They move on their own. As soon as the tiger and the tigress have had their close dealings, they don't live together. And when the tigress has the children, she brings them up. As soon as they're big to be on their own, they go their own way. Lions stay together, but tigers don't. That's why it says tigress, not lioness. Right? Because lions, I think, mate for life. You know, they're very controlled in their senses, like that. Okay. For a man of bad conduct is blamed amongst people, constantly suffers misfortunes, is afflicted with diseases, and short-lived. Yeah, bad karma is blamed amongst people, then one always has a bad reputation. Then suffers misfortunes, there's always difficulties for him. Afflicted with diseases, these are all symptoms of, and short-lived, these are all symptoms of impiety. Impiety is uneducated. Uneducated, has all chronic diseases like that, legal difficulties, you know, can be poor, not attractive, you know, physically unattractive. These are all signs of impiety like that. So, you know, and people always speak bad. You know, that's why it's these things are there, is that someone's born like physically deformed, people will not want to deal with them because it's come from very sinful activities. So the nature is just what's the big deal about the body? We're attracted by a nice body because it's created from piety, and we're not attracted to a body that's ugly or deformed or in some way different, because that's created by impurity, by impiety. You know, so it's subconscious. It's subconsciously there. But that's why it's those things are given. If someone's behaved badly, and so then in the next life, people will have a natural disdain for their association. Like that. So is Krishna's arrangement. But for the devotee, we understand it's the soul. And the soul is just, you know, they have their bad days. So some days they're pious and they're in a good situation, and some lifetimes they're in a bad, impious, and they end up in a bad situation. So that's not the important aspect for the devotee. So he's able to see everybody equally. You know? 158. A man who follows the conduct of the virtuous has faith and is free from envy, lives 100 years, though he may be entirely destitute of auspicious mark. Auspicious mark. So here is the point, is someone who follows the virtuous conduct like that, then he has the faith, he is free from envy, and he has long life. So this is the answer to the question there, is that if the boy or the girl doesn't have all auspicious marks, but they are virtuous, you know, they follow very naturally sadhana and the etiquette, and they have faith, then, I mean, from that they have that faith, they're not envious of others, you know, they'll be very broad-minded in dealings, you know, it means broad-minded, not liberal, broad-minded. And they can work with others. Sorry, I always make this distinction, because there is. Mahatma doesn't mean liberal. Mahatma means he sees the bigger picture. Liberal means you only see, it's the mind, right and wrong, and just you're liberal on wrong, and not so strong on right. Like that. Broad-minded means you see how everybody needs to, what is their condition, nature, and you find some, you accommodate whatever is needed for their position to be engaged in the Lord's service. So it's a difference. Prabhupada was broad-minded, not liberal, because he was very strict. But he was broad-minded, so he could find a place for everybody. You know, New Age is liberal. It doesn't mind bending standards, dropping standards to accommodate people. But that's not the Vedic concept. The Vedic concept is you find some position according to the Vedic standards, whatever, someone can be engaged in the Lord's service. You know? Like that. Yeah. Okay. Then?
That verse that we just read. And it's that verse in the Upadeshamrita, that if the devotee's body is deformed below the earth, then it's to be considered like the Ganges, which is covered by mud or foam during the rainy season, which remains completely pure.
It's an important point. Because the point is, the devotee, it doesn't matter. Because the thing is conditioned nature is always there. There's nothing completely 100% perfect. Only devotee can be 100% perfect. You know? If someone's the most pious in the universe, he ends up as Brahma. We see Brahma also has problems. You know? He's not able to fully understand Krishna's position. Or like that. All these different things happen even to him. And he's the most pious. You can't get more pious than Lord Brahma. You know? Like that. Still there's problems. So only the devotee, actually, that's the real... The real thing is that one is a devotee of the Lord. That's the real thing. Other things are not so important.
Very good.
Good point. Okay, then the next section here describes about being independent. Independent meaning, okay, here. 159, let him carefully avoid all undertakings, the success of which depends on others, but let him eagerly pursue that, the accomplishment of which depends on himself. In other words, things that you can get done yourself, that should be your main emphasis. And those things where you depend upon others and always... You want to get it done, you're always pushing. Others have to do it. You saw it and you say others, oh, they have to do this, they have to do that. Why no one's doing this? Why no one's doing that? Because it's got nothing to do with yourself. It's bound to fail. Because you can't accomplish it. So that's the whole point of the occupational duties. Take a position in which you can get the thing done. You know? If you can organize others, then you do that. Because you can get it done yourself. And you know how to engage others to get it done. So you can engage the other person to get it done. Because you know how to follow up this and that. But where you depend upon the others is, I can't do it, I depend upon the other to do it. There'll always be anxiety, because one will always be let down. His material nature things don't run smoothly. So I expect this to happen, and then the modes of nature, things happen, and then it doesn't happen like that. So then I'm in anxiety. I'm dissatisfied. Does that make sense? Yeah, so what you do, like if it's something to study, you study it yourself. Those things that depend upon others, then it's always a problem. What you can do, do that. And then cooperate with others, and then everybody does what they can do, and everything works nicely. Mm-hmm. Like that. Someone can lead, he should lead. Someone can follow, they should follow. And then it works well.
Prabhupada criticized bureaucracy and centralization a lot.
Yes. Because then the thing is it gets so big that the person on the top actually can't control the whole thing. Because bureaucracy and all that's not coming from... The monarchy doesn't work like that. Monarchy is not a bureaucracy. Bureaucracy means got to go through this paperwork, go to that secretary, go through that paperwork, and then go through here, and then the committee, and then they do this and that. It's just papers and people moving papers. Monarchy is direct, dynamic. There's a person on the top, the buck stops there. In a bureaucracy, then everybody can get out of it. It wasn't anybody's fault. And everybody can think that they're in charge. And everybody can get the facilities they want as being in charge. Right? Like as soon as you create a new committee, then it's got to have money. And where's the money come from? They don't generate it themselves. They have to get it from someone else. So they can't generate funds. They can only spend it. You know? Like that. They may have a chairman, but you know, it's dependent on the whole vote. So he can't be held responsible. You know? So it turns out to a really strange thing. So the Vedic thing is you have in management, you have someone there, and he says this is what will be done, you know, by his training and experience, and then others follow that, and it gets done. So you can take the decisions immediately. Otherwise, bureaucracy means somebody comes up, hey, we got to do this, and says, okay, we'll come next Monday and put in a proposal, and we'll discuss it. You know, and at the meeting, what do? There's 10 people in the room, and all those 10 people are fully busy. Right? It's just one more committee that they're on. And in the committee, you have to get something done. So then they make a resolution. And then after the resolution, someone has to execute it. So what do? They look around for the 10 people in the room who are already up to their eyeballs in work. And then they try to convince one of them to do it. Or, okay, well, we'll discuss next week and we'll, you know, someone will check and see if this other person can do it. And so everyone's satisfied, it didn't fall on their head. And then next week, well, this guy said not, well, we'll think about it some more and come on, and then the whole thing disappears. You know, so when it gets centralized, sometimes you have problems like that. Other thing is another aspect, you may have somebody very good organizer, tries to centralize everything, but then he's not there to know exactly what's going on in the situation. So even in a good, you know, powerful organization, still the individual units have to have their autonomy. Because the guy on top can't make decisions on everything. You know? Like the king is not making decision when they're going to plant rice in the field in the villages. No, the villages do that themselves. Like that. He just sees that the country is safe so that the villages can plant their rice and harvest their rice without it getting stolen. You know? And because it's run according to religious principles, the rain comes on time, there's no calamities. So the centralization, and the problem is if one thing goes down, the whole thing goes down. But if you have many, many units that can work together, right, that takes more cooperation. It takes more cooperation.
Also in the first canto, Prabhupada mentions, I think Prabhupada mentions it, or it could be in the translation, that the life is shortened due to over-dependence on another's mercy.
Yeah.
Same point.
Because one is always anxiety then. If one is not dependent, then one is more free, and then there's no anxiety. You know, because you're following, you're doing what you're supposed to do, you're performing your duties. But the point is there must be controlled senses and not an overabundance of material desire. Then one can live like that. Like you see, Brahmins can live very simply; they don't care. Kshatriyas also. You know, so many times you see Kshatriyas just living in the forest. Either the young, they don't have the kingdom yet, or they're older, they've given up the kingdom to their dependents, or they've lost the kingdom. You know, and they're living in exile. And they live out there, live in their grass hut and just perform their sadhana and things like that. So you see the Brahmin Kshatriyas, and that detachment is there.
Sita and Rama are happy.
Yeah, Sita is nice. It's very, no anxieties. You know? Like that. No anxieties. You know, minimal anxieties. Very, very minimal. You know, running the kingdom is a big anxiety. Because the thing is nowadays people like to get a big, big position because of the facilities they get from it. But they don't take the responsibility that goes with those facilities and the position. In the Vedic time, is they took the responsibility to give that shelter and all that. So there's anxiety because they have to protect everybody. But it's their service. They have that ability, they do that. So then if they don't, they're living in the forest, they're very happy. They have no problem. No problem, no anxiety. Because the position is there to do their service. They have the ability to rule. And so they do it as a service. They're not doing it for their own sense gratification. Duryodhana is. Dhritarashtra is. But that's why there's a problem and there's a war. But the others aren't. You know, as soon as Ram hears he's supposed to go to the forest, fine, he goes to the forest because it's his duty. He's supposed to perform his duty. So his duty is to rule the kingdom, he does that. If his duty is to go to the forest, he does that. It doesn't matter to him. He just does his duty. Does that make any sense? Yeah, so there's independence. The Brahmin, the Kshatriya, the Vaishya, they're independent. Right? independent doesn't mean they're not under spiritual authority, not under the authority of the scriptures, because this is all in relationship to virtuous behavior. So that means one has to follow. But one is not dependent upon others for livelihood. One is doing something that he himself can manage. You can manage a big business. It means you're doing it yourself. You know how to engage salesmen and those who can purchase, and accountants and cleaners and, you know, all these things to do all this stuff. So you're doing it yourself. They're just assisting. But where you can't do it and you depend upon them to do it for you, that's the problem.
So the main thing is that if they can do their duty, then they're happy.
Yeah, if you can do your duty, what you can do yourself, then one is satisfied. So if one can do something small, he does that. He should be happy with that, because then he'll be satisfied. He tries to do something bigger, he won't be satisfied, because he won't be able to run it and maintain it. Does that make some sense?
What is it? Even Krishna says it's better to do one's duty imperfectly than to do another's perfectly.
Yeah. Means there is, the idea is I'll do someone else's duty because I want the facilities of it. Mm-hmm. Like Duryodhana, you know, he could run the kingdom very nicely. No one's complaining how he's running the kingdom. But it's not his duty. So that's the problem. Mm-hmm. You know, because he doesn't have the nature to do it. He's not an emperor. He could be a small king. You know, under the emperor, but he can't be the emperor. He doesn't have the character for it. You know, he's not seeing to the spiritual welfare of the planet. Yudhishthira is, the others aren't. So generally, the interest in doing another duty, because you think the facilities of that duty, the position of that duty, like that, is desirable. Like that. And so better to, you see your nature, you know what it is, and then do that the best you can. And then whatever level you can do it at. You know, and be practical. Do it at that level. If you can do big stuff, do it. You should do it. If you don't do big stuff, then that's not properly engaging your nature. You know, if someone is a big manager, he should do big management. Otherwise it's not a proper utilization of his nature. If someone can only do small management, he should recognize that and stay a small manager. He should not try to take on a big position. Who?
Hridayananda Maharaj gave an interesting analysis of the Varnashram system.
Huh.
He said, for the Brahmins was anarchy.
Huh, yes.
Nobody's in charge of them, no one's. They follow the scripture.
Huh.
And then for the kings is monarchy.
Huh.
Then for the Vaishyas, there's covetousness.
Hmm.
That they have free enterprise.
Huh.
They pay taxes.
Yeah.
And then for the Sudras, it's communism.
Communism or socialism.
Hmm.
Yeah, like that. Yeah, yeah. No, that's what's going on. It's all happening at once. That's why when they try to take one and make it work, it can't work. Right? For communism, then you got to get rid of all the Vaishyas and all the intellectuals. Because even though they say everybody's equal, they say, what is it? Every man?
Everyone's equal, but some are more equal than others.
No, no. That's Animal Farm. It's some pigs. All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. That's from Animal Farm. That was a book satirizing the there's one, it's Marx's saying about somehow everybody according to their ability and according to their need or something. Because everybody does an activity according to their ability and everyone receives according to their need. So it sounds great. But now, the idea is that it's just a pure proletariat thing. It's just shudras. But who's to decide what is their ability and whether they'll be engaged, and who's to decide what is their need? That he doesn't get. Therefore, you end up with you know, uncultured, you know, how you say, leaders. You know, you have an untrained, uncultured, so-called kshatriya class, and then shudras. And to follow it means no one should overly think or be observant. So you have to get rid of the Brahmins, you have to get rid of the Vaishyas. So that's what they did in Russia. Mm-hmm. And then the whole thing didn't work. And if you just call a pure monarchy, then you see that they get rid of the intellectuals, the clergy, mm-hmm. like that, like before that. And if you work it just on the anarchy, everything falls apart. And if you just work on capitalism, you can see now, your modern democracies and all that, then they have a tendency to just base everything on money. So what makes money, that's what they do. You know, if a war makes money, then they have a war. You know, whatever will create money, that's what they do. So they'll sell anything if it makes money. People don't need it, and they advertise to make them think they need it. You know, so it's just, so you have to have the balance of all them. The Vaishyas do their capitalism, but they have to be controlled. They just sell things people need. You know, Shudras, they work on socialism. They're taken care of, but they have to be submissive and work under somebody. They have to be cared for by somebody. You know, the monarchy then does their thing and rules, but they have to be submissive to the Brahmins. The Brahmins maybe work on how you say it? Materially they may be look like anarchists, but spiritually they're not. They work purely under the scriptures. And the Kshatriyas have the right to control them, to not control them, but to see that they're doing the duties. Mm. They're acting as a Brahmin, doing the duties of a Brahmin, having the qualifications of the Brahmin, then they're accepted as Brahmins and they're left alone. They don't pay tax, they don't have, you know, they're left alone. They just do their teaching, because by nature, if they have a Brahminical nature, they're going to teach, you're going to follow. By nature, they're going to follow the laws of God. So in that way, they're not anarchists. But if they're not up to that standard, then the king can readjust or punish or properly situate them. Like that. So they're all, everybody, you know, everyone has their say. You know, even the Vedic system, democracy is there up to the lower court. You know, the peoples and the mass, the peoples are all represented by their own elected people. Hmm. In other words, they represent themselves to the monarchy through their election. Mm-hmm. You know, but it's not on big, it doesn't work like that. For one guy, you don't have one guy and everybody votes on him. It's like that. One in the village, everybody knows, and who's the natural leader of the village, he's a leader. Then you have 10 villages, they work together, and so there's 10 leaders, and then from amongst them, the most mature, most capable is elected. Then from 10 of those leaders, you know, means from 10 leaders who are in charge of over 10 villages, then one of those is leader. Then you have, next rung is over 100 villages. So however big your country is, there'll be that many levels. Hmm. Like that. So that's all democracy. And they represent the people and all this and that. Then they present that to the monarchy, and then the monarchy then does what they think's best. Like that. So it means the democracy stops at a certain point and the monarchy takes over. Mm-hmm. You know? And the Brahmins, they're anarchy, but it's only for themselves. Mm. They can't, they don't put that on anyone else. The kings rule. They give advice, but the kings do what they want. It means the Brahmins speak to the king, but that's, once he's said it, it's up to the king to do what he wants. So he gets the glory if it works nicely, or he gets the blame if it doesn't. The buck stops there with the king. It doesn't go to the Brahmin. Because the Brahmin gave him the advice doesn't mean if something goes wrong, it goes back to the Brahmin. Because the king had full choice to do it or not do it. Mm-hmm. He's not forced. You know? So this way, they're each one checks and balances the other. You know, the Brahmins see that the king is properly doing. If not, then they either have to train him or somehow or another arrange that someone else has put in place. You know, so it's the checks and balances are automatically there by running all four systems at once. Yes. Speak loudly. Yes. Somebody, I suppose, somebody else, which is going to be missing a bigger amount of ego, and then he cannot be confused by it because he has identified so much with external identity. Uh-huh. Hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. You understood? Is that? Everybody could hear? Yeah, that's
who's
good
to decide what one's nature is?
Who's to decide what one's nature is? Generally, that's seen by the teachers first, and then the king is to make sure that it's actually practically applied.
What about if the teacher is saying, you should do menial service here in the ashram, and the disciple's thinking, this isn't my nature. He's directing me against my nature, and I'm not satisfied, and my mind's not peaceful, and I can't study.
Then the point is the then the student should have chose that teacher. It means that's this period of testing. So the teacher gets to see what the student's nature is, and the student gets to see what the teacher's nature is. So in that time, it has to be decided if they can work or not. Because you have to accept authority. It means the student means he's not trained. So now it has to be decided, is his dissatisfaction in doing that menial service due to not having the nature to do menial service, right? Or is due to his ignorance, right? Now, menial service is not a problem for a Brahmin, you know, a real Brahmin, because that naturally goes, service creates realization. Brahmins are interested in realization. So they know the direct connection. If I do menial service in knowledge, I get realization. And the goal of the Vedic whole process is realization. So the Brahmin has zero problem with that. If he has a problem with it, he's not a Brahmin or he's not a good Brahmin. You know, there's something wrong in his nature. You know, he's not a Jnani, he's a Jigyasu.
Mm-hmm.
And Jigyasus can easily, once they get what knowledge they want, then give up Krishna. Jnanis can't, because their purpose is to please Krishna.
Jigyasus are more kshatriya, isn't it?
Can be. Kshatriyas are very interested in just knowledge, and that is a challenge. You know, it's a new area of knowledge. That you can look at it in that way if you want to break it down according to the varnas. But just within that is you have, you know, like your scholars, you know, your mental speculative scholars. They don't like you see the normal thing that of the materialistic Brahman that they're attracted to is jnana, because jnana means no work, right? The process of jnana means no karma. So they figure this is study. I sit down all day and I just study my books all day, do a little chanting and little, you know, whatever my particular ideal of worship or sadhana is, you know, every man to themselves on how that is. Don't bother each other. Like you go and see sadhus, like you go to Kumbh Mela, each one has a little different what they do. And it's kind of like the unspoken rule is you don't bother or criticize someone else if it's according to some rule of the scripture. You know, if they're doing something weird, you know, standing on their head and doing artik or something like that, then somebody might say something. But you'll always find somebody wild enough to think that, yes, this is great. But otherwise, those who are more interested in the scripture, they may say something. But otherwise, this one worships Ganesh, and that one worships Durga, and this one Shiva, and that one that. Then nobody says anything. And that's the one who's a jnani. You know, karmi means they do the activity because they want the fruit. You know, I'll do the menial service as long as I know what I'll get from that. Oh, if I do menial service during the festival and I do work really nice, then afterwards we get to go to Puri. Okay, I'll do it. Because I want to go to Puri. I don't care for the devotional service. I want to go to Puri. So Krishna's mentioning Gita, Nishkam Karma Yoga. Means you perform the activity, but for Krishna's satisfaction. So that's the perfect blend. So that is the thrust of the Vedic culture, is to perform the activity for knowledge. Right? Tadvidi pranipatena pariprashnena sevaya. Pariprashna seva. You gain the knowledge, and then you perform service. Then there's realization. Otherwise, it doesn't come. So if someone can do, then definitely they're not of a good quality of a Brahmin. Maybe a materialistic or one who's a jnani or a dvijabandhu. Kshatriya also, no problem doing the service, because to that degree they can follow, that degree they can lead. An emperor has zero problem doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, a big king also. You get down to smaller king, maybe like that, you know, then... Because it's just, you know, To that degree that they can follow, to that degree that they're great. Like that. That just naturally comes. So it's not a kshatriya. The vaishya will be what's the benefit. If I'm getting some benefit out of it, I'll do it. Right? Shudra is just lazy. It's the mode of ignorance, so they don't like to do it. You know? Like, they'll only do it if they have to. You know? It's if you don't do it, there'll be punishment. Or, if I don't do this, I don't eat. You know? Like that. This is my job. I clean the streets. If I don't sweep the streets, they don't pay me money. If I don't get my money, I don't eat. You know? Like that. So it's only by that that they'll work. So that's one major way to tell in the Gurukul who belongs in the Gurukul, is simply by the service. That's the Vedic thing, is they didn't actually teach him anything for a year. A substance. They would teach him, you know, means, you know, basic language, reading, writing, numbers, you know, histories, anything like that. But they didn't teach him philosophy, they didn't teach him Vedic madhags, they didn't teach him ritual and worship.
They teach him anything that you learn in a modern school.
Yeah, whatever you could learn in a modern school, they would teach like that for the first year. And then after the first year, they decided, is this boy fit or not? And if he was, they would keep him and then teach him everything. But what they were watching is the service. Do they have the proper service attitude? Do they deal with the other boys in the ashram properly? Do they have the proper respect for the teacher? Do they know how to maintain that respect even though it's an informal atmosphere? Because Gurukul means informal. But the student has to maintain that formality that is essential for the student-teacher relationship. It means the teacher never comes down to the level of the student. He'll present things at the level of the student, but he himself never comes to that level. And the student never then thinks he comes to the level of the teacher. So that familiarity is never breached. Right, like that. So it's a very subtle thing that's there. So only qualified people can work in that. Otherwise, they come familiar like that. You know, the students think they're a big guy. You know, like that. As soon as they get a Brahman thread, then they're big guys, and then they don't have to do any work anymore and stuff like that. You know, so the teacher sees that. And when he sees that, then, okay, this is not my student. Maybe someone else's, but not mine. You know, they're over-familiar, they don't deal with others properly, they're harsh with other students, especially if they're junior to them, they're very harsh with them. These are all symptoms that they're not fit for the Gurukul. So like that. So one has to see what is the nature of it. So then one sees all this is good, then he has to follow. One can't want to be in the educational institution and not follow the rules of that education, because each educational institution is set up for a particular purpose. You know, like you have a teacher who's expert in Sanskrit grammar. He's teaching grammar. So he's going to organize his program to teach grammar. Right? So you're going to do the basic services and basic activities, and the study is going to be grammar. If you don't like grammar, you don't like the activities that go along with it, then one wouldn't choose that school. One would choose another school that would have the program and the study that fits the nature. Like that. So it's, you know, that point is there. The authority must be accepted. If you don't accept the person's authority, don't go to their school. Means if he says, you have this nature and you should do this, you know, if you don't like that, then you shouldn't have been in that school. Then you should just know that this person is training in a way that's good for some people because they like it. Modern idea is if one person doesn't like it, then the whole system's useless. Unless it's good for everybody. But it doesn't work like that. You know? Actually, if you look at the modern world, it doesn't work like that. In some people's minds, they think it works like this. This New Age idea, everything's all equal. It's not equal out there in the material world. Not at all. They have music schools, they have law schools, they have medical schools, they have, you know, they have management schools, you know, army schools and things like that. They have general schools, they have remedial schools, they have, you know, how you say, practical, you know, practical skills, you know, like that. Schools, they have economic schools, You know, they have schools for training priests. I mean, there's tons of varieties of schools out there.
In Poland, the system is that primary school is general. High school is specialized.
That's interesting.
Economics, or car mechanic, or medical.
Yeah. Well, that's practical. Because Prabhupada even had that. He said up to the age of basically 10, 12, you know, all the kids could go to basically the same kind of training. But after that point, they had to be trained according to the nature. If the boy had good academic brains, he went into deep academics. If he didn't, he went into something practical. And they would split it that young. British used to do that, called 11 plus exams. At 11 years old, then you took these exams, and they decided whether you went to grammar school or you went to a practical training, you know, trade school and things like that. And it worked very great. And then, you know, the modern, you know, whatever it is, then he'll feel bad and this and that. No, he'll feel great. The guy goes to his trade school. At 18, you know, he's, you know, master in some area, and he's bringing in big bucks. You know, you send him to the grammar school, you know, he'll flunk out of the grammar school, unless you drop the standards so much. And then, what is he going to get a job doing? He doesn't have the intellect to move in that circles. He's not a leader in that way, you know. He may be a leader of you know, supervisor on a construction site, but he's not a leader of businesses or leaders of an office or leaders politically. So it's totally a stupid system to not let people train according to their nature. And so that should be seen. If one is not satisfied, then he should join that kind of system he's satisfied in. Satisfied means everybody's satisfied, you know, like that. So it's a natural.
Also, in the West, they must have the same training. Even the useless guys, because then the useless guys will naturally fall in line as losers for those who are actually the smart people. Because actually the smart people are the ones who are on the top. So if this loser, not losers, but academically not so inclined, go and start making trade at the age of 11, by the time they become 18, they're going to be their own man, they're going to make their own money, and they're going to be perfect outside in an environment.
Yeah.
They're going to be controlled by them. So let them attend the same school. Let them be completely impressed upon as you are a loser, you're born a loser, you're going to die as a loser. And they can just fall in and serve as an idiot for the rest of his life.
Yeah. But nowadays, that's even that understanding is not there.
Yeah.
Because the point is no, you have to cater to the loser. You drop everything to the lowest standard, you know.
You're the best.
Because you are, just because they're of low, they are, how you say, academically...
Challenged,
you know, like that, or
he's like in Hungary.
Academically, yeah, in challenge, yeah, or impaired.
Already in primary school, there is each grade's got three groups. There's the first grade, group A, group B, group C. So group A, the guys have a little bit more brains, and group B, less brains, and group C, like even less. And so from the time they're 6 years old, they're like. Yes, you are a loser, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, see.
Yeah. And so it's the thing is that if there's no exploitation, then the different levels are very, everybody's happy. Because everybody just wants to be comfortable and feel protected and feel secure. So no one, you know, someone can be the top, someone can be the bottom, as long as they feel that they're secure in doing that, following the nature. The problem comes is if there's no security, leaders don't protect those under them, then those who are under them, they want to take care of themselves. Because they're supposed to be, their right is to be protected. If you're a follower, your right is to be protected. But your duty is you have to surrender to the leader. Right? So the leader, his right is that he gets to control it. But his duty is he has to protect everybody within the system. You know? So in the Vedic thing, the emphasis is on the duty. When the duty is there, the rights automatically come. The modern is the emphasis is on the rights. No one talks about duties. You know? Like that. Someone has to have the proper balance. Otherwise, there's always dissatisfaction. You know, you see the system becomes very liberal, and then when crime and everything and all bad qualities come up, then they start to become more conservative. And then in trying to cut down on that, then they also infringe on people's, you know, normal, you know, needed rights and all that, so then it becomes more liberal again. So the Vedic thing is you just take the center line and you understand what is everybody's duty, what are their facilities, and then just see that it maintains at that. If anybody doesn't follow theirs, then that's improper, you know. We'll end here. Continue tomorrow, same place, same time. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jai Srila Prabhupada ki jai.